Prana was touching on this yesterday, and just some of the points that are made here, it kind of reminded me of these verses from the eighth chapter of the first canto. So Kunti, she's praying to the Lord. You know, he's just about to leave for Dwarka from Hastinapura, and she's feeling separation. She doesn't want him to leave because she's really... Kunti's such an elevated soul that she's understanding that Krishna's her life and soul. Without Krishna, her life is meaningless. And all the Pandavas are actually feeling that. They're feeling that very, very strongly. And so the thought of Krishna leaving is just devastating Krishna. They know no one but Krishna. You know, Krishna is their life and soul. Krishna is their savior. Krishna is everything for them. And in every calamity they face, they just turn to Krishna. And so I just want to read these prayers from the 23rd verse. There's four prayers, I think. She prays, O Hrishikesha, Master of the senses and Lord of lords, you have released your mother Devaki, who was long imprisoned and distressed by the envious King Kamsa, and me and my children from a series of constant dangers. My dear Krishna, your lordship has protected us from a poisoned cake, from a great fire, from cannibals, from the vicious assembly, from sufferings during our exile in the forest, and from the battle where great generals fought. And now you have saved us from the weapon of Ashvatthama. So in some of those, you can see Krishna was directly intervening. But in most of them, he wasn't. You know, the weapon of Ashvatthama, he directly intervened. And then during the battle of Kurukshetra. But, you know, the poison cake. You know, you may remember the story of the poison cake where Bhima was fed this poison cake and then thrown into the river by the Krishna, by the Kauravas. And they had thought, Kunti thought he was perished. But what happened is when he fell down, you know, when he sunk down in the river, that he was bitten by all these Naga serpents who were living in the river. They bit him. And the poison they were injecting into his body counteracted the poison of the cake. And then he went to the Naga kingdom. And I think he married... Did he marry Ulupi or was that Arjuna? Anyway, he had some connection there with one of the Naga women from memory. Anyhow, so he struck up a relationship with the Nagas and then they returned him back to Hastinapur. And then also it mentions here from the cannibals, you know, Hidimba, the Rakshasa. Now, like a normal person, like a materialistic person, is going to think, actually, by the might of my arms, I you know, like we know the story how this Hidimbi Rakshasi, she fell in love with Bhima. And then her brother Hidimba, he became very annoyed with that because he said, you know, this is my dinner and you're falling in love with him. You know? And so he was going to kill her, then kill Bhima and eat him and then kill all the Pandavas as well. But Bhima didn't like that idea and so he decided to kill him. And in the end, he actually snapped him in half just by the power of his arm. And they were just ripping up all the trees in the forest and smashing each other with trees. I mean, very powerful personalities. But Bhima killed him very easily. But like I said, a materialistic person would consider that this has come about by my strength, you know, that I've killed this person. And then the other one there is from the vicious assembly and from our sufferings in exile in the forest. And in the vicious assembly, we see also how the Kauravas wanted to, you know, they stole everything from the Pandavas through, you know, with loaded dice. They had crooked dice. Sakuni, he was a master of dice, and he could by his potency, the dice would roll whatever number he wanted. You know, and they knew that. They knew he was crooked. Yet still, because Dhritarashtra had asked them to do it, you know, out of respect for their elders, they did it. And even in that situation, they were saved by Krishna's arrangement. They, you know, they could have seen it was their own endeavor. They could have seen that they got out of that by their own endeavor. They could have seen they got out of the other things by their own endeavor or by some arrangement of chance. But because they are great devotees, because they are completely surrendered to Krishna, they just saw this has come about by Krishna's mercy. So that's an interesting point there. And then the next verse, which was particularly, I thought, particularly interesting, Kunti prays, I wish all those calamities would come again and again, so that we could see you again and again. For seeing you means that we will no longer see repeated birth and death. So, you know, she's saying that, you know, every time there's a calamity, we think of you. And when we think of you, we're protected. This is actually the attitude of a very elevated soul. My Lord, your Lordship can be easily approached, but only by those who are materially exhausted. And this is what happens here, we'll see in this story. You know, like Dhruva's motivation is he wants to have a kingdom greater than the kingdom of his grandfather, who is Swayambhuva Manu. And actually, ultimately, he wants a kingdom greater than that of Lord Brahma. But the process of bhakti, we see, what's that? I think the verse is recorded in the Hari Bhakti Suradaya, where, you know, after he achieves this benediction from Krishna, then he prays to the Lord. He says, "My Lord, you know, I was seeking broken pieces of glass, meaning this great kingdom." You know, he actually got awarded the pole star, which is, you know, it's quite extraordinary because it's the only spiritual planet in the material universe, and that's where he resides, and the Lord resides there also. He got awarded that kingdom, and he considered it, like, once he'd attained the mercy of the Lord, he considered that kingdom to be no more than a broken piece of glass. He said, you know, by your association, I've received the most valuable jewel. So he understood that. So Kunti, she's seeing this. She's saying that, you know, my Lordship can be easily approached, but only by those who are materially exhausted. One who is on the path of material progress, trying to improve himself with respectable parentage, great opulence, high education, and bodily beauty, cannot approach you with sincere feeling. So these are all well-known verses. And there's a particularly interesting statement Prabhupada makes at the end of the first purport there. He says, the conclusion is that Krishna endows more favor to a devotee who is in greater dangers. Sometimes he puts his pure devotees in such dangers because in that condition of helplessness, the devotee becomes more attached to the Lord. The more the attachment is there for the Lord, the more success is there for the devotee. So we see that sometimes devotees are put in positions of calamity or difficulty, and because they're devotees, they don't start to take shelter of their own capacity, their own ability. Oh, you know, I'm very intelligent, I'll figure this out. I don't need Krishna. I'm very strong. I can conquer this. No. We see that, you know, someone like Kunti, someone, even Arjuna, a great Kshatriya, he, you know, at the start of the battlefield, the start of the battle of Kurukshetra, he was completely overcome by emotion. And as we see, you know, Prana was talking about this yesterday, emotion's not a bad thing, but he was overcome by material emotion. He was thinking of his own welfare, the welfare of his family, you know, brothers and this, and he was also thinking of all his relatives. He didn't want to kill his relatives because ultimately he was thinking that would impede his sense enjoyment. Yet, being a great devotee of Krishna, he took shelter of Krishna. He said, Karpanya dosha patam sabhavam. He said, you know, please instruct me. You know, I don't know what's the right thing to do, so you instruct me what's the right thing to do. And then at the very end of the Gita, in the 18th chapter, what does he say? Karashe vachanam tava, that I'll do what you say. Because he's a devotee. He understands that the only way that he can really get out of this situation, because we can make so many material adjustments and make the situation a little bit more comfortable. You know, we might get a softer cushion or get a nicer car or get this or get that, make some material adjustment. But ultimately, it doesn't deal with the problems we're all facing. You know, it may adjust some temporary issue, but it doesn't deal with the problems of birth, death, old age, and disease. These are the things that everyone has to face. Every living entity goes through it. One time, I quote this a bit because I think it's really funny. One time a reporter was asking Prabhupada, he says, why is the death rate in India so high? No, the death rate is the same everywhere. 100%. And that's the fact. We're all faced with that. We all have to go through the same things. So, you know, making some material adjustment, which is what Dhruva was trying to do. He's trying to make a material adjustment to make his situation better. Yet, ultimately, we see that Narad Muni advises him, this won't help you. You know, this is what's happening here. He's saying, this is just the workings of the external energy. You're trying to manipulate that. And we see that, you know, the living entity in this material world, he's trying very hard to manipulate the material energy. This is what the Bhagavad Gita explains to us. He's trying very hard to manipulate the material energy. But in the ultimate end, he becomes manipulated by the material energy. The living entity becomes controlled by matter, by his attachment for matter. And we see, you know, like it's an interesting place to have a temple in Albert Park, because in Melbourne we see that, you know, materialism is quite rampant here in Albert Park. You know, and most of the people here have no interest in trying to better themselves spiritually. They don't even understand, you know, spirituality for them means to do yoga or something like that, you know, something for the material body. And you probably find that many of the people around here do yoga. And that's their spirituality. Or they might, you know, read, you know, some spiritual book. Different, you know, the Book of the Dead or some book by Gojo or something like that, and think it's spirituality. You know, they don't really understand. And that's the point that Kunti's making here, is they don't really understand, or they cannot understand, you know, they cannot approach Krishna with feeling because they're so attached to enjoying the material nature. And this point is made by, same point is made by Rishabhdev. What's that verse in the fifth canto? I can't remember the verse, but he basically is saying that, you know, that, you know, those who are trying to improve themselves or trying to, you know, who think that sense gratification is the aim of life, they'll never understand this Svarta Gatim Hi Vishnum. They'll never understand that the supreme destination or the supreme goal is actually the lotus feet of Vishnu or Krishna. They're thinking of two cars in the garage, you know, kids going to a fancy school, etc., etc., etc. You know, beautiful wife, beautiful, handsome husband, you know, all this kind of stuff. That's what they're thinking is the goal of life. And they endeavor so hard for that. They'll work, you know, and go through great difficulty. And at the end of their life, they achieve frustration. It's only frustration they achieve because they don't understand actually what is the goal of life, what should be their destination. They need to understand, and this is the point that Narad Muni is making here to Dhruva, is that, you know, intelligent persons accept this process because they, you know, and Krishna makes the same point in the Gita. He says, "Aham savasya prabhava mata sarva pravartate iti matva bhajante mam buddha bhavasa manvata." Buddha bhavasa, the intelligent nature. You know, they worship me with all their hearts. He says, "I am the source of all spiritual and material worlds. Everything emanates from me. And the wise who know this perfectly, they worship me with all their hearts." So they understand that everything comes from Krishna. Therefore, you know, if we understand that everything I have comes from a certain person, don't we feel a sense of gratitude or indebtedness to them? You know, a normal person with balanced emotions would naturally feel indebtedness. But because, you know, people in this world, they don't understand, firstly, they don't understand where it comes from. They think it's all coming by their own endeavor. But what did they come into this world with? Nothing. What do they leave this world with? Nothing. In between, they may have some, you know, things to play with. They don't actually realize that it's all coming about by the arrangement of Krishna. Everything we have in this world is come about by Krishna's mercy. Whether you understand it or not, whether you accept it or not, it's all there by Krishna's mercy. So, Krishna points out that an intelligent person, understanding this perfectly, worships me with all their heart. And Narada's making the same point here to Dhruva Maharaj. An intelligent person will engage in that. And a very important point he's saying here is an intelligent person should accept that process, the process of bhakti, and be satisfied with whatever comes, whether it's unfavorable or favorable. It doesn't really matter. Because it's like this verse, Matra Spasas to Kunteya, Sitoshna Sukudukuta. You know, like me, you know, I thrive in hot weather. That's a big part of the reason I moved to Moolambar, was because it's so much warmer than here. When it starts to get cold, I don't like it. My fingers crack, you know, it's like skin gets really dry and stuff like that. It's really uncomfortable for me. So you can tell by that, you know, and we'll read this first. I'm not particularly advanced in spiritual life because I can't tolerate these things. You know, I should just tolerate. That's what Krishna's telling Arjuna. Just tolerate these things, because ultimately it's just sensory perception. And so he's saying, you know, this appearance of happiness and distress we see in this material world. We experience so much happiness, we experience so much distress. But later on, the Gita, Krishna also points out, he says, sukhe dukkhe samakripa. Become equal in happiness and distress. Don't be elated when something nice happens, and don't be depressed when something unpleasant happens. Just be equal, because it comes and goes. And that's the nature of everything in this material world. It comes and goes. Because why? Because it's material. Material means temporary. It's asat. Everything in this material world is temporary. We need to accept that. Doesn't matter how much we like it, doesn't matter how much we paid for it, or how much we're attached, or whatever it is, you know, how big, how strong. Even the Himalayan mountains, no matter how big they are, you know, the tallest mountain, I think it's what, 29,000 feet or something, tallest mountain in the world, it's temporary. It will come, it will go. Everything does. You know, it's described in the New Govardhan. We're reading, I think it's the third chapter of the first canto right now, which is Krishna is the source of all incarnations. And we're just going through the section there where it's describing at the beginning it describes the Purusha avatars, because there's two questions the sages ask. They ask about they want to know the incarnations of Krishna in this material world. It's essentially asking about the creation, the incarnations that cause creation, and then he's asking about the lila avatars. They're asking about little avatars. So in describing the incarnations that deal with creation, it's describing the nature of this world and how it goes through various annihilations. There's partial annihilations, there's full annihilations. So with the partial annihilation, they happen at the end of every day of Brahma, where the whole universe is inundated with water. And everything is destroyed. All life is, you know, all vegetation, animals, etc., all destroyed. And all the jivas, they enter back into this shushupti, or sleep, into the navel of Vishnu. And then at the end of Brahma's life, there's a total annihilation where all the planets are destroyed. So, you know, in our short time frame, we might think things last forever. You know, they may last longer than that. We do. You know, in our short, you know, like in this short old age people's home, and seen what people get like when they get into, you know, 80, 90, 100, 100, you know, over 100. I don't really want to go there. You know? It's like, you know, one of the worst things is they still, this planet. So we see that you know, to get an idea of the different durations of life and how time is relative to the observer, as Albert Einstein pointed out. If you look at that pastime where Brahma came and stole the calves and the cowherd boys, 1 year had passed. It was just a moment for him. And according to Vedic time definition, a moment is an 11th of a second. So he put them in the cave and turned around and he was back there. And that was 1 year in Braj. So, you know, his time, because it says Sahasra Yuga Paryantam, his 1 day, his 12-hour period, is 1,000 ages down here. A long time. 1 day. But, you know, his time, in terms of Vishnu's time, his whole lifespan is one breath. Lord Vishnu breathes out, Lord Vishnu breathes, even less than that, because he's not immediately created. Lord Vishnu breathes out, Lord Vishnu breathes back in. That's Brahma's life gone. One breath. So, you know, don't get too attached to what's going on here in this material world, because it's only here for a short time. We're only here for a short time. So while we're here, use the time wisely. Don't use the time for trying to gather more and more temporary things, because they will come and go. And at the end, all you'll be left with is your attachments. And what's the value of that? It's going to lead you to more and more attachments. It's going to lead to you more and more suffering. No, you know, as Prahlad Maharaj points out, he says, Komara Chaprakyal Daman Bhagavataminam Durubam Manasam Java Tadapiya Duruva Markadam. You know, an intelligent person uses this human form of life to actually practice devotional service. Not to focus on these ephemeral, temporary things, which we see everyone in this world is focusing on. They're just trying to get more and more possessions, enjoy themselves more and more. At least they think they're enjoying. But, you know, if you ever, I don't know if you ever look at those fail videos they have on YouTube, you see people that, like, they're trying out there trying to enjoy themselves, and they wind up doing some pretty stupid things and wind up hurting themselves very grievously sometimes, all in the name of enjoyment. So, you know, and you know, the same point that Prahlad Maharaj makes, we see that Rishabhdev makes in the fifth canto. It's some amazing instructions in the fifth canto, but he points out that, what's that verse? Nayam deho deha bhajam riloke kastam karmam ahate vidbujam ye tapo dibhyam putrika yena shatvam shudyad yashvat brahma sokhyam tonantam. That one, you know, he's explaining that basically the human form of life is not meant for getting this sense gratification, which is available for the hogs and the dogs at each stool. And if you look at, you know, that may, you know, some people may think that's a very harsh comparison. But if you look at it, what are the hogs and doing? Hogs and dogs doing? They're eating, they're sleeping, they're mating, they're defending. That's all they're doing. What are the human beings doing in this material world? They're eating, they're sleeping, they're mating, they're defending. It's no different. Maybe the quality is different. The dog, you know, sleeps on the street. The hog sleeps in a pile of rubbish. You can see them in Vrindavan. They like it. They sleep in a pile of rubbish. Or in the winter season, they'll sleep on an extinguished fire, so they're getting the warmth from the coals, but it's still not a clean place. And a human being might sleep on a soft bed. Or they're eating. You know, human beings, they may eat, you know, fancy cooked preparations. You know, I like this and I don't like this and all this type of stuff. Whereas the hogs, you know, they're eating stool. Some like the stool like this, some like the stool like that. It doesn't matter, it's the same thing, they're still eating. They're still getting nourishment. And so all these things are this, it's the same thing, it's just different quality. So, and Rishabhdev explains, it's like, don't be like that, don't be like the animals. Human life is meant for tapol dibyam, for practicing austerity by which you achieve the divine, by which you understand Krishna, by which one ultimately understands Brahman, the supreme Brahman, meaning the supreme personality of Godhead, not Brahman meaning the Brahmajyoti, but Parabrahman meaning supreme personality of Godhead. That's what human form of life is about, and that's what Narad Muni is getting to here with Dhruva Maharaj. He explains to him, it's like, you know, you take up this process, you're intelligent. You know, he says, you know, an intelligent person will do this, but he's not trying to flatter him, but, you know, he's pointing out, you're an intelligent person, take up this process. Don't be attached to what comes, because it comes and it goes. Everything comes and goes in this life. We really need to, you know, be aware of that. And that sometimes it's going to be a very distressful situation. Sometimes it's going to be a very happy situation. And sometimes it's going to be in between. Don't be bothered by that, because it won't last, it'll change. It's just like, I remember when because, you know, I was brought up in Melbourne, but my family went travelling, and we went to, lived in Malaysia, and then when we came back from Malaysia, we lived all over the place. And so material life is just like the weather in Melbourne. Yeah? It always changes. Yeah? It's like, you know, I remember when I first got back here, one of the devotees said, oh, you don't like the weather in Melbourne? Wait 5 minutes, you will. So it's like that in material life, you know, right now you're suffering, you don't like this, oh, don't worry, that'll change. And at some point, you know, down the track, you'll be happy. And you just look, you know, you just look at children, you know, like sometimes they're crying, sometimes they're happy. They change so quickly. And it's often, you know, like as you get older, you tend to see this happening. And I know, like, oftentimes when you're dealing with young people, you know, in the late teens and 20s and things like that, you know, they're so intense about what's going on. They'd be, you know, like they're so happy or they're so excited, you know. Oh, I'm so excited, you know. Oh, I'm so confused, you know. It's like going from one thing to the next really quickly. And the only thing I can ever tell them to is just be patient. It'll change. It won't stay like that. Yeah? And we see that it does. It always changes. That's the only constant in this life, is change. Nothing stays the same. So just appreciate that. Appreciate that it's all going to change. Appreciate that right now you're happy, maybe. That'll change. Unless it's spiritual satisfaction. This spiritual satisfaction, it's as Krishna points out in the Bhagavad Gita, in the 8th chapter of the Gita, 9th chapter, sorry, Rajavijja. He said, is Rajavijja Rajagujyam Pavitram Idavutamam Pratyaksha Savagandam Susukam Katam. It's everlasting, it's joyfully performed. So this devotional process is everlasting. Why? Because it's spiritual, it's transcendental. Transcendental has no beginning, no middle, no end. It just exists. Whereas material has a beginning and has an end. Everything in this material world goes through the same basic changes. It's created, it grows, it remains for some time, it produces byproducts, it dwindles and it vanishes. Everything. There's nothing in this world that doesn't vanish at some point. But spiritual life is eternal. And that's why we see here that Narad Muni is encouraging Dhruva down the path of spiritual life, because he's a great personality and he's intelligent. He's distressed. That's the material side. He's experiencing suffering because of what's happened in material life. He's saying, but you know, you're intelligent, get past this. Take shelter of the spiritual process. Then you become happy. You become peaceful. It's the same for all of us. We're all in the same situation. If you really want to become happy and peaceful in this life, don't worry about what the material world offers you, because ultimately you get dealt a bad hand. Ultimately you'll become dissatisfied in one way or another because you lose it all. And we see, you know, just like in Australia we have the example of there was this one fellow, wealthy fellow called Alan Bond. A very wealthy person, you know. And he achieved great fame and notoriety in the world. You know, he was the first person to take the America's Cup from America after 100 and so many years. I can't remember how many years it was, but you know, and that was a big thing. He was like a national hero. I think he died last year, a poor man, no money, in debt, in an old age people's home, with dementia. You know, so, you know, at the height of his success, he was like famous, known around the world, practically, you know. And at the end, what's he got? Nothing. And that's what material life offers you. Nothing. It offers you nothing at all, because it's all temporary. So, Narad Muni is offering Dhruva Maharaj eternality. The great sage Narada instructed Dhruva Maharaj that one should be satisfied in all circumstances. So this is the paritushit. All circumstances. Not just the nice ones, all circumstances. Be satisfied. Don't be always looking for more and more and more. Just be satisfied with whatever comes by the arrangement of the Lord. Everyone who is intelligent should know that because of our concept of bodily existence, we are subject to suffering and enjoyment. One who is in the transcendental position beyond the bodily concept of life is considered to be intelligent. One who is a devotee especially accepts all reverses as gifts of the Supreme Lord. Imagine that, huh? Accept all these reverses as gifts of the Supreme Lord. It's just like that verse I was reading, Vipadashantatashatatashatatashatatashatatashatatashatatashatatashatatashatatashatatashatatashatatashatatashatatashatatashatatashatatashatashatashatashatashatashatashatashatashatashatashatashatashatashatashatashatashatashatashatashatashatashatashatashatashatashatashatashatashatashatashatashatashatashatashatashatashatashatashatashatashatashatashatashatashatashatashatashatashatashatashatashatashatashatashatashatashatashatashatashatashatashatashatashatashatashatashatashatashatashatashatashatashatashatashatashatashatashatashatashatashatashatashatashatashatashatashatashatashatashatashatashatashatashatashatashatashatashatashatashatashatashatashatashatashatashatashatashatashatashatashatashatashatashatashatashatashatashatashatashatashatashatashatashatashatashatashatashatashatashatashatashatashatashatashatashatashatashatashatashatashatashatashatashatashatashatashatashatashatashatashatashatashatashatashatashatashatashatashatashatashatashatashat Why? Why would anyone pray for that? Why would anyone pray for difficulty in this life? Kunti's praying for these things is because when the difficulties come, because of their of being great devotees, they just take shelter of Krishna. This is coming, and a really nice purport in the 12th chapter of the Gita, where Prabhupada mentions that, he quotes that verse, and then he talks about how the devotee appreciates that, actually I should be suffering so much more than this, but Krishna out of his kindness has reduced this to a token, just to remind me that in my past life I did these things. So Prabhupada is saying here, that one who is a devotee especially accepts all reverses as gifts of the Supreme Lord. Krishna has given me this gift so I can understand the temporary nature of this material world, how I can understand that he's my only shelter. If we take this perspective, we're always going to be satisfied in life. But if we take the perspective that, why am I suffering? This is due to this person's, you know, done this to me, or this person's done that to me. Then we'll never be satisfied in life because we'll always be looking for something better. But if we can just accept that everything has come by Krishna's arrangement, then we'll be peaceful. When a devotee is put into distress, he accepts this as God's mercy and offers him repeated obeisances with his body, mind and intellect. An intelligent person, therefore, should always be satisfied depending on the mercy of the Supreme Lord. So very, very important instructions here that Narad Muni is offering to Dhruva Maharaj. And things that, you know, if we can really take to these instructions deeply, it's going to help us to become satisfied in this world and understand that we're not of this world. We're actually, you know, we're spirit soul, and our business is to serve Krishna and to get out of here as quick as we can. So I'll finish. Any questions at all? Okay. Thank you very much. Oh, cool.
We're talking about how material nature does take away everything with time, and so, you know, when we're going out and preaching about Krishna consciousness, people do see spiritual life as something very optimistic, but then they still don't lose their optimism to material life. So that's still there, and then, you know, they're quite optimistic about the material life, but then, okay, they also do the spiritual life. So, how do we talk about the...
It's kind of different for every person you deal with. Every person you deal with is going to respond to things differently. Some people who are currently having a tangible experience of suffering, then for them, when we present Krishna consciousness to them, it's much easier. But for, you know, oftentimes when you're dealing with young people, the notion of suffering is just so foreign to them, because, you know, they're in the prime of their life, and their consideration is they're enjoying. So you try to talk to them about suffering, it doesn't really resonate so well. So when you're talking with people like that, a strategy is to actually, you know, look at how to connect with them. What is their interest? And show them how that interest is also there in Krishna consciousness. You know, somehow or other. You know, and see, we see here, it's like Narad Muni's not telling Dhruva, you know, material life is this, material life is that. He's talking to him about, okay, you want this, so you do this, and you'll get what you want. You know, why are you criticizing these people? Why, you know, Narad Muni is very expert at connecting with people and presenting Krishna consciousness to them in a way that they can understand, that they can really identify with it. So what's going on in their life? And so he starts off by presenting to Dhruva Maharaj, you know, that, well, you know, the way you're speaking to the way you're feeling towards your stepmother and your father, this is not going to help you. And he's preaching kind of morality and you know, you need to adjust your behavior and stuff. And then we've seen a few verses. Dhruva Maharaj says, look, that's really nice, you know, but I can't identify with that. You know, so then Narad Muni just goes straight to the main point, and then he gets that. So we see that, you know, expert preachers are able to, and Prabhupada was very good at that. He was able to connect with people. And I've seen other, you know, senior devotees, you know, really connecting people. I remember one time I was in Poland, and Indra Maharaj was there. And we had this experience where we were setting up, I can't remember the name of the place, we were setting up on the foreshore at an inlet where the fishing boats were there, and there's a lighthouse there. So the area we were setting up was like the forecourt in front of the lighthouse, and apparently the guy who was in charge of the lighthouse was actually in charge of that area. We didn't know that. We got permission from the, well, not we, the devotees didn't know that. They got permission from the local council or whatever you call them there. But when it came time to set up, the lighthouse keeper, he just stopped it. He said, no, you can't do this. You have to get permission from me. So then Indra Maharaj came along, and he was talking to this gentleman, you know, through a translator. And he started to say, oh yeah, he said, no one understands what it's like to be a lighthouse keeper, you know, because in the lighthouse you're there on your own, late nights, all this kind of stuff. No one really understands. And the guy started to emotionally connect with Maharaj, because he was trying to, you know, connect with him on a one-to-one level where he could understand. You know, he was saying, you know, I understand what it's like for you. And so then as a result, this man really started to develop a lot of affection for Maharaj. He said, you know, I'm in charge of this area, you can have your program here. Yeah. And so when we're speaking to people, that's the trick, is to try to, you know, try to find out what's important to them. And then use that, you know, if we're intelligent, connect with them through that. So, you know, just to tell them, oh, you know, you're suffering in this world. Is that important to someone? If someone's really suffering, you know, if their wife's just died or their children have died, then you can connect, but you don't want to sort of labor the point, you're suffering, because they already know that. You know, they don't want to make them feel more miserable. You know, it's just like if you talk to a short person, you say, oh, it must be horrible to be short. That's like rubbing salt in the wound. You know, so the idea is just to try to connect with them in a way that makes them feel better. Because and the fact is, even if they don't know it, they're suffering. Everyone's suffering in this world. The fools don't know it. Intelligent people do. So just try to connect with them in a way that they feel inspired. They think you're a nice person. They want to find out, you know, well, why are they so nice? What makes these Hare Krishna people nice? And then, you know, the best thing is if they start to ask you questions, then it's like, you know, it's like when you're fishing, you know, and you throw out the hook. When the fish starts to nibble, you've got him. But if you're trying to, you know, hook him and he's not even anywhere near the hook, you know. So you got to, you know, I never was very good at fishing. The only thing I ever caught was myself. I cast the hook out, I used to catch on the bait. But just got to, you know, try to connect with them. Because then they think you're the friend. Anything else? Okay, thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada ki, Samaveta Bhaktivinda ki, Jayanita Gaur Premanandi.